call this meeting of the Elections Committee to order. Thank you, everybody, for being here after being here last night. A quorum is present. So may I have a motion to approve the minutes for February 28th, 2023? Representative Davis, thank you, has moved approval of the minutes. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the minutes are approved. The first bill on the agenda is House File 535. Representative Frazier, welcome to the committee. So I will move that House File 535 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Frazier, would you like to describe your bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, committee members. Thank you for having me here this morning. So essentially what House File 535 would do, thank you.
That'll look at the good of the minutes.
What House File 535 would do is it would give school boards the opportunity by resolution to reapprove operating referendums that have been previously approved by the voting members within their school district. Currently, they don't have that power. They don't have the power to levy like many of our other government bodies do. They have to take these things to the ballot. The issue with that is it creates much uncertainty. It also requires to put much resources into that. And as a parent and as someone who has worked on advocating for these referendums to be passed, I understand the stress and the uncertainty that is there. And what we're trying to do here with this situation is create an opportunity where districts don't have that uncertainty, communities don't have that uncertainty, and it doesn't create this uncertainty of whether or not you're going to fall off a cliff because you no longer will have these operating referendums in place that have been previously approved by your voters. Now, there's four conditions that must be met before the referendum can be approved by the school board. The per pupil dollar amount of authority renewed must be no more than the existing referendum. The term of the referendum must not exceed the term of the initial referendum. The board must hold a hearing on the proposed renewal and allow for public comment at that hearing. And the board must take action by adopting a written resolution authorizing the renewal. That is the bill. I will yield for a testifier comment.
Thank you. We have two people who've signed up to testify. First is John Vento from the Robbinsdale School Board. Welcome to the committee, Director Vento. If you could please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg and members of the Election and Policy, Election Finance and Policy Committee. My name is John Vento. I am a school board member of the Robbinsdale Area Schools. I've been serving as a school board member for the past 10 years. I want to thank Representative Frazier for introducing this bill. It is a really important piece of legislation for school boards and students across the state. With House File 535, school boards are not asking to have an increase of levy authority. We are only asking to renew operating levies that have already been approved by voters. Robbinsdale Area Schools currently has two operating levies that passed in 2014 and 2018, with well over 60% of voters' support. We are dependent on our two levies. They provide vital services to our students, such as maintaining lower class sizes, offering diverse courses, co-curricular activities, and investment in professional development around the science of reading for our PK through 5 and special education staff. In 2014, we estimated the levy renewal was the equivalent of staffing for 5 of our elementary schools. These are daily operating costs, not luxuries. Permitting school boards to renew a referendum at the same level after a public hearing would save thousands of taxpayer dollars that school districts are required to spend informing the public and conducting another election at no additional cost to the state. Robbinsdale Schools paid over $100,000 in required costs in running the campaigns, including printing materials and personnel costs for the 2018 referendum. Our community supported our efforts by raising an additional $20,000 for a citizen committee, along with countless volunteer hours. Anytime we ask our communities for a levy, these campaigns cost our districts and communities the same amounts. School boards are elected by the same voters who vote for legislators, city councils, county boards, town boards. Why are school districts the only governmental body that has to pass a referendum for operating costs? In our last referendum, we had overwhelming support from our 7 communities, city councils, and mayors. When speaking with these representatives, I've always asked how they would feel if they had to go to the voters asking for any increase of funding. We are elected on, to represent our communities on the same ballots. Why are school board members receiving a lesser value or second class? I am unaware of any other elected body that has these same limitations put on over the same time. Finally, the public supports this. According to Morrison Leatherman surveys over the past several years, they have consistently shown a majority of Minnesotans support allowing locally elected school boards to renew existing school referendums, including a majority of Republicans and Democrats expressing that support. To further support this, since 2014, 132 of 133 renewals have passed, 99.3%, often with overwhelming majority. Prior to 1989, there were no limits on operating referendums. Once it was approved, it was in effect as long as the board decided to make that levy. Legislative changes since then have diminished a school district's ability to provide budget stability, limiting the duration and capping the dollar amounts for operating levies. House File 535 is a sensible, responsible step to help school districts provide stability for our budgeting process and return local control to school board members to renew voter-approved levies. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Director Vento, and I like the beard.
Thank you, Mark.
Next on the list is Matt Hillman, from Superintendent from Northfield Public Schools. Welcome to the committee, Superintendent Hillman. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Sue.
Good morning. My name is Matt Hillman, and I am the superintendent of the Northfield Public Schools, and I live in Northfield, Minnesota. Good morning, and thank you for allowing my testimony today on House File 535, Chair Freiberg and Representative Frazier and members of the committee. I truly value the public service that you provide for your constituents and for the state of Minnesota. As said, I am Matt Hillman. I'm the superintendent of the Northfield Public Schools, and I'm currently the president of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. MASA represents over 600 active superintendents and central office administrators throughout the state. And House File 535 is a vital policy priority for our school leaders. I'm going to highlight three things. The first is we believe this bill is just good policy. It places locally elected school boards on a more even playing field with city and county governments. Not a completely even playing field, mind you, but simply a bit more even. It gives schools greater certainty in long-range financial planning for school administrators, and longer-range planning allows school districts to be more strategic in its plan and its planning and programming. My second point is that the bill maintains voter decision-making. Voters obviously must pass the initial operating levy. Elected school board members have the option to renew the levy at the end of its term using the same parameters as the voters initially approved. Voters may ask school board candidates their position on renewing existing operating levies and consider their perspective when they're casting their ballot for school board members. And of course, the board always retains the right to take the option to voters to renew the operating levy instead of renewing it themselves. It certainly doesn't preclude a board from doing that if that's the right thing to do in their community. We think it's really important to note that the public will have many opportunities to weigh in and that this bill provides parameters for that public input. Just a few examples of how the public can provide that input. They can give feedback directly to board members through email and through public comment. They can provide their feedback during the annual Truth and Taxation public hearing. And of course, they can write letters to the editor for those people who still do that and use digital means to be able to provide their perspectives. And finally, we believe that this bill just makes sense. Operating levies are almost always renewed by the voters. As the fiscal note indicated, over the last 8 years, more than 99% of operating referendum authority renewals have been approved. And allowing school boards to renew operating levies for the same amount at the same duration as previously passed by their voters does relieve school districts of the cost to run an election. In summary, I encourage you to support House File 535. It gives locally elected school boards similar but not exactly the same taxing authority as city and county governments by allowing them to renew operating levies within the same parameters as previously approved by voters. The public has ample opportunity to provide feedback about the potential renewal and can hold board members accountable for the decisions when they run for re-election. Finally, this bill would provide school districts and school leaders with much-needed financial stability and the ability to effectively plan much better in long-term budgeting, which we all know how important that is for our school districts. So I thank you for your time today and appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, we can turn to member discussion. Representative Plum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and having also served on the school board and been very active, well, I served on the Zed governing board, which is multiple school districts, and understand a lot of the financial issues. One of the big differences with schools, my school district has been the lowest or in the bottom three per pupil funded school districts in the state of Minnesota for over a decade. It also has lower than the state average tax capacity per pupil. So it's not a property-rich district, and it's a low-funded district. But we also have had several years of 100% graduation. We have, I think in the last testing on math, we had twice the proficiency that Rochester had, and Rochester's a good district. And that's because the community is involved and engaged. We talk to the community. We have a conversation. I have seen too many school districts that didn't have those good relationships, and there have been repercussions. I understand the intent. I wish there was a mechanism so that there could be X percent, say a petition with X percent of the people that voted in the last, election in the school district precincts could trigger that it'd have to be held as a referendum. My fear is that we will be having parents think and citizens think that they're not involved, they're not being asked. The most local control are the local citizens. Mm-hmm. And too many school districts have had problems because they've lost touch with the community and the parents. I understand the intent. I think that this isn't quite right because it doesn't have some sort of mechanism so the parents feel more engaged. I continually hear about school board meetings of where there's just a few minutes allowed for public comment. You have to sign up in advance, and it constrains public discussion. It isn't always fun, those public discussions, but it allows the community to feel as if they've actually been heard and engaged. And that's how you have success. And I want success for the students. So I wish that this was a little more, or had more content, not dictating exactly what content, but would like to have some discussion so that we could maybe improve it. Because I think we've seen over recent years a lot of angst from the community and parents, and I think this is a difficult time to do this with that environment. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Frazier. Just a real quick question. So as you're bringing this to the Elections Committee, obviously, so this is bypassing an election. And my question to you is, in other areas, other states, how many other states do you know of that are doing this?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not aware of how many other states are doing this, but I will say I think it's inaccurate to state that it's bypassing elections. It's requiring that there's a hearing specifically for the board to be able to reinstate this. And as you heard the school board director state that, you know, this is a situation where it would be an election issue, right? You would have members of the public, voters, potential voters, saying, how do you stand on this issue? And if you don't stand in a way that is commiserate with my values, I'm not going to reelect you or vote you in as a school board member. So in that sense, I think it's like any other issue. It allows for voters to actually have direct impact on it. If they have concerns about that issue, they get to address it directly with the individual running for school board. So it doesn't bypass election. It requires a hearing so that voters and communities can be engaged. And I heard what Representative Quam said. I think engaged communities are a very important part of the successful outcomes for our students and for our school districts.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. I guess, you know, where I'm at right now, and I would hope everybody's at, you know, but from the majority party, we hear a lot of language like democracy, transparency, you know, we want accountability. And something like this, to me, is bypassing some of those words and language that we like to use. So even though I hear you saying that we still could vote out a school board member, and that's absolutely true, what this does is, I believe, it's disenfranchising the voter. And what it's doing is making it easier for the school districts. It's bypassing the public in some ways. And so for me, I don't think that we should take something out. You're not saying that this is popular in other states. This is just a checks and balances, right? I mean, this is just one more tool that we have in the toolbox of checks and balances. And as government, I really feel like we should not always be going for the easy path. Democracy isn't always easy, and maybe that's the path that we need to take. But I do think there's unintended consequences. And again, could it be very unusual? Yeah. But could it be like one out of 100 school districts, different problems? And for me, the ease to just simply push this through, it does not trump that we should be doing the process the way that we normally do it.
Mr. Chair, may I respond? May I respond to that? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, appreciate the comments. So I think it's inaccurate to state that this is a bypass or disenfranchising voters. This doesn't take the voters' rights away to exercise their voice in our democracy. In fact, it requires a hearing so that they can exercise their voice at that hearing, particularly for the approval and the continuation of this referendum, operating referendum. And I will say, they have to actually get voters to support the referendum and pass it the first time around before they can come back and have this discussion with voters to ask if they can reinstate it with the same terms. They can't increase the terms of it. It would be the same terms. So I hear what you're saying about transparency. That's why the hearing process is in there. It's requiring folks to engage. The referendum has to be approved the first time around before they can actually have it in place to have the conversation the second time around. So I think the transparency is there. It's encouraging engagement with the hearing process. So I think all those pieces, the things you just talked about in democracy, accountability, transparency, and also voters having their voices heard, it's all built in here. It requires that.
Thank you. Representative Coulter.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, thank you, Representative Frazier, for bringing this forward. I talked with some of my school board members literally just this last weekend, and this is one of those sort of recurring process issues that they really, really struggle with. And I was struck, when Director Vento was speaking, I kept hearing the phrase, why are school board members the only ones who? And I'm not going to go off on all the silly things, frankly, the silly limits I think that we put on how school boards operate. But I know a few of us here were previously on city councils, and we don't have to go to the voters every time we want to fund something. I shouldn't say we, because I'm not a city council member anymore, but we just put these limits on school boards that we don't put on literally any other elected officials in the state, not on city council members, not on county commissioners, not on township board members. And I think it really does hamstring our school board's abilities to serve our students and our communities. And they are duly elected by the voters. It's the only local government body that faces these kinds of barriers and difficulties. And I think it's not necessary. It's not helpful. It doesn't serve the public any better to do this. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Frazier for bringing this forward. I assure you that with my school boards, this is a very popular idea. I've been around a long time, but I was not here for the Minnesota Miracle. But my understanding of that is that it was really an effort for the state to take over the funding of our school districts, and that puts school boards in a different position than other local government officials. And this need for levies is one that's created by, unevenness in the formula, where some school districts are put in a position where they just can't meet their needs and have to pass these levies, try to pass these levies, in order to properly fund their school districts. But it's important to remember that these levies aren't, it's not just your standard, doing all of the operations of the school district. Most of their funding does come from the state. And I'm generally a local control guy, and when I talk to my school boards and talk about school decisions, I really want to empower my school boards to do the work on a local basis. But here the local control is at a much deeper level. It's at the level of the voters, and I really feel that disenfranchising the voters in this case is a mistake. The repairs that need to be done are repairs in the formula, not to make it easier to tap into the local taxpayer for these emergency funds. I realize we're just laying this over, Mr. Chair, but my remarks are to you, I guess, then, that you would carefully consider whether or not you're going to roll this into an omnibus bill, because I would like to vote no, but I won't get that privilege.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Torkelson. Well, I mean, since you mentioned it, I mean, like Representative Coulter, I served on a city council. We had levy authority there, and just to me, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense that school boards don't have the authority, and in my mind, this bill respects the authority of local officials. You know, our state constitution guarantees a uniform system of education, and kind of kneecapping school board members, I think, undercuts that constitutional duty. You know, this bill is pretty limited in scope. It doesn't authorize referendum increases. These are just renewals of expiring referenda. You know, there still has to be public testimony at the school board hearing before they renew it. The initial referendum would have been approved by a vote, so there is, a buy-in from the electorate in that school district. And the school board members themselves are also politically accountable. So, you know, I authored this bill, I think, a few years ago. It's one I strongly support. So with that, do you have any closing remarks, Representative Frazier, before we get over?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just really would like to push back on the idea that this is disenfranchising voters. It could be further from the truth that it's disenfranchising voters. Like I said, the process is built in to encourage and ensure that there's engagement from the community on this issue. And I also used to be a city council member, so I come from that perspective as well. I also used to work in a school district where we had some pretty raucous school board meetings, and I can tell you unequivocally that when members showed up to address concerns, you saw that impact, and you saw school board members listen to that, and they made their decisions based on that. So I think the process is built in, and I think this is a good bill. I think it's good policy. In fact, we used to have it in place, so we know it was good policy at some point in the state. I think we need to get back to it. So I hope we can find a way to get this done this year.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. So with that, I renew the motion that House File 535 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Thank you, Representative Frazier. Representative Becker-Finn, you are up next. The next bill on the agenda is House File 789. So I will move that House File 789 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Representative Becker-Finn, would you like me to move the A1 amendments?
Yes, please, Chair.
Okay. Is there any discussion to the A1 amendments? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted. The bill is in the shape you would like. To your bill, Chair Becker-Finn.
All right. Thank you, Chair Freiberg. So this is the second year we've brought this bill forward. It was previously carried by Majority Leader Long, but I have carrying this mantle. So you may or may not know, when you filed for office, there was an ability to keep your home address private. if you had filed a police report or if you had an order for protection. What this bill does is extends that ability if a candidate has a reasonable fear in regard to their safety. So this is specifically having to do with the personal safety of folks running for office. To ground us in why this bill came forward and why we started working on this, I just want to remind folks, you know, that we live in a post-January 6th world. We know what groups of people are capable of, and we know that sometimes elected officials are personally targeted. In addition to that, around the same time, maybe folks don't know about that this happened, but around the same time as January 6th, we actually had armed crowds of people showing up unannounced at the personal homes of some of the people we serve with. Was very unsettling and scary for those families. Many of them had children who lived in those homes, and there were further threats for folks to show up at other people's homes as well, including my own. In addition, I'm actually curious. I don't know. I mean, I guess we've got some newer members, but others may not be aware that for some of us, threats against our personal safety by the public because of this job that we do are very common. Particularly for folks who come from marginalized communities, particularly right now, our queer friends and allies and folks that we serve with are getting death threats on the daily. We have members of our of the legislature who don't feel safe bringing their children here, who want to make sure that their families are protected. Now, we know that we don't get paid very much to do this job. It is public service. And so this bill is in recognition of the least that we can do is do what we can to keep folks safe in their homes. Obviously, we come into this building every day. We can be found and are accountable to. I've had groups of angry people outside my office here, and that would be the appropriate way for the public to reach us and get our attention, and that would still remain an option in these buildings and spaces. But recognizing that as a part-time legislature, citizen legislature who doesn't have access to security services the way that someone maybe in Congress would have, that the least we can do is try to keep people's home addresses private if they do have that reasonable fear for their safety. So that's what the bill does. It just includes that you wouldn't have to actually go through the process of getting an order for protection or filing a police report if you do have that reasonable fear. The amendment was at the request and suggestion of the Secretary of State's office to just make it really clear that there's still a way that they can double check to make sure we know that that residency is accurate. So that's the bill, and happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. No testifiers have signed up. Are there any members of the public who wish to speak on this bill? Okay, seeing none, we can turn to member discussion. Representative Bonner.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Beckerfin. You know, I just want to say thank you for this bill. I will tell you, I personally have had threats telling me that folks are coming to me with a meme of someone pointing a barrel of a gun. This is when I first came into office. I don't think I had barely been in office but a few weeks. I hadn't even had time to do anything to irritate anyone. But I pride myself on being a really reasonable, thoughtful legislator in a purple district. And a year or so ago, as you mentioned, with folks coming around with armed individuals with flags and bullhorns and the whole bit, and they had gone to several legislators' houses, and for some reason, which I have yet to figure out, they put me on their potential list. I remember having to work with our local law enforcement and thinking really hard about how that was going to impact my neighbors. Now, I do this job every day, and I am more than happy to face the scrutiny. I signed up for this. I'm willing and ready and able, and I think we all are. You know, but at that same token, I have next door to me two little children. On the other side of me, I have three young boys, one of whom has various disabilities, and he does not do well with a lot of chaos or loud noise. He gets very upset. I have an 80-year-old woman and my elderly neighbors who all meet at the end of my driveway every morning to go walking. That 80-year-old neighbor has the beginning stages of dementia. I remember sitting there feeling really nervous about a group of armed people showing up in front of my house with my 80-year-old neighbor with the beginning stages of dementia walking into this, being scared and frightened. The child across the road from me being scared and frightened. I don't think that my neighbor signed up for that. I don't think that's fair. And it's only been in the last few years that we've seen this trend where folks are actively going to people's homes. We saw Representative Lucero put a bill before us to suggest that we'd be able to use campaign funds to get security measures in our homes. Not going to lie, I've been thinking about it. And I think this is, it is sad that we are in a place that we should have to hide where we live as elected officials. I'm proud of my job. I am proud to serve this state. I have no problem with my neighbors knowing where I live. But when we have some of the threats that we've been experiencing in the last few years, I think this bill is absolutely necessary, and it is a step that we need to take to protect not necessarily ourselves, although I know that some folks who have children definitely do, but also just our neighbors, our neighborhoods. And I think if they did not sign up for that, it is not fair to ask them to put up with that. And so I really appreciate this bill, and I want to thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Huang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want the public to, the author in her opening seemed to indicate more of one side, or it's only certain groups, or it's just recently. Because, frankly, when I was a freshman, there were, even in the Capitol, a mob came and confronted me. Sergeant of Arms person started to approach. I waved him off, and I engaged, because personally, I don't think you show a mob that they can intimidate or prevent you from doing something, showing them that they're powerless. But I also know someone, a current member that was elected about 10 years ago, and his first run, 300 people showed up in front of his house in his neighborhood, and the neighbors were really concerned, and rightfully so. That's a scary thing. So I think the option of protecting your residence and your home address is very prudent. I wish that people hadn't given out the address of the Supreme Court justices. So the courts should also be given this discretion if they choose. Because no matter how we personally stand up, aren't intimidated, we have families, neighborhoods, communities that they should not suffer. So I support the intent. I know there have been efforts in the past to do things to help on this issue, but I just want to make clear for the public that this is not one group, one side. It's a universal problem that's been around for a bit of time. Maybe it's gets bolder some years, but I'm going to support this, as we all should.
Thank you,
Chair.
Chair Beckerfin.
Thank you. Just wanted to respond. I just want to be clear. I never stated at all that in any way that this is partisan or only one side. I assume that none of us in this room were supportive of the insurrection that occurred on January 6th. So there's no partisan intent implied or stated. So I just want to make sure that's really clear.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think we all, or at least most of us, certainly understand that our private lives should have some protection. I just want to make sure I fully understand the amendment and the purpose of the amendment and just exactly how the mechanics of the amendment work, just to make that clear for all of us since it's new to the bill.
Chair Beckerfin.
Thank you. So, again, this was language that the Secretary of State wanted to make sure that they would be able to double check, you know, to make sure that we don't have people filing for office who don't live in their districts. And so the way that this would work is if you were choosing to do this, to use this exception to not have your private address, you would fill out an affidavit that would still have your address on it, but that would remain private. And what this is doing is requiring that within one business day of receiving the filing, a staff person from the Secretary of State's office would still verify that that address is in the district where the person has filed to run. So it's actually making sure, they wanted to make sure they can double check so people have faith in the fact that people actually live in their districts where they're filing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that and I understand the purpose, but isn't that already part of the system? Isn't there an option to fill out an affidavit?
Chair Beckerfin?
I think I've got somebody for, I mean, I've got the Secretary of State's right here, but I don't know.
I was hoping I'd get the real Secretary, Mr. Chair, once.
He has
a
Secretary has he's exceptional staff.
He's got it.
He's avoiding
me. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and respond to the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nicole Freeman, Office of the Secretary of State. So currently, state law allows, at the request of another voter or another individual, allows the option for the filing officer to check the address, but does not currently require the filing officer to confirm that the address is within the district the person is filing for if they've marked the address private. So this would make that a requirement.
Dave Torkelson.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no additional members seeking to be recognized, Chair Beckerfin, any closing remarks?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members, for your support. I just want to say too, you know, there's scrutiny, and then there's our personal safety, and whether you live alone or have children or have neighbors who would be impacted, the reality is that none of us, we signed up for this job. We did not sign up to put our personal safety at risk, and that I don't want to see a world where we have folks not filing for office because they are concerned about their personal safety. And again, I signed up to serve my community. I did not sign up to put my children and my home at risk of violence or any other harm. And I think that's true of all of us. So really appreciate the support and the discussion. I think this is an important and simple thing that we can do. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. With that, I will renew the motion that House File 789, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. The next bill on the agenda is authored by yours truly, so I will move to the testimony table and turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Green.
Looks like the last bill on the agenda is House File 1723. Chair Freiberg, would you like to move your bill?
Sure. I will move that House File 1723 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Finance and Policy.
Chair Freiberg moves House File 1723 be recommended to be re-referred to the State and Local Finance, Government, and Policy Committee, a mouthful. Chair Freiberg, to your bill.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill contains provisions that are in the governor's budget. I'll just summarize the bill here. Section 1 of the bill removes the requirement that federal Help America Vote Act or HAVA funds have to get appropriated by the legislature. These critical funds are used to enhance election technology and make election security improvements. But over the past few years, the funds have been used as leverage in legislative negotiations that are unrelated to election security. We should trust our election administrators to use the funds prudently, and this section would do so. Section 2 is a one-time request for approximately $477,000 for the payment of court-ordered attorney fees as a result of the Minnesota Special Redistricting Panel's resolution of redistricting matters. Under federal law, plaintiffs are entitled to seek reimbursement for attorney fees and costs associated with redistricting litigation. The court has granted reimbursement. There's an incentive to pass this and pay it sooner as interest is accruing. Finally, Section 3 is a one-time amount of $461,000 to meet state matching requirements that will allow the Office of the Secretary of State to utilize just over $2 million in federal Help America Vote Act funds to secure and improve Minnesota's election systems. That's the summary of the bill, and I believe Secretary Simon is here to speak to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Secretary Simon, the man himself. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Member. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. Thanks for letting me say a few words on this, and thanks to Representative Freiberg for carrying this bill. I think Representative Freiberg effectively set the stage. I don't want to repeat that, but I just want to add a few relevant details for your consideration. As he mentioned, there are basically three parts to the bill. The first part pertains to federal funds under the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, an acronym if you don't know already, you're probably going to hear a lot about. HAVA was passed in 2002. It was a bipartisan bill under then President George W. Bush. And Congress has periodically since then used that bill, the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, as a vehicle bill to appropriate money to secretaries of state for various elections purposes. In recent years, I'd say from 2015 or 2016 onward, the purposes have been pretty focused on election security. And Congress has wanted states to have some skin in the game. So it's not just, hey, states, hey, secretaries of state, here's some money. It's, hey, here's some money, but we're going to ask for a match. And the match has ranged all over from 5% to about 20% now in recent years. So they're saying, hey, if you, the state, can come up with 20%, we'll give you the other 80% here. The catch is it has to come, the state match has to come within 2 years of the appropriation. The problem here, and the reason we're before you, principally, is that Minnesota has a law on the books, we believe it's unique among all 50 states, that allows the legislature to basically intercept HAVA money and sit on it. So Congress appropriates the money to the Office of Secretary of State, and the legislature in this state, because of this quirky law, can basically stand in the way. And the law, I don't mind telling you, has been abused. The most blatant example came in 2018. Congress appropriated money to all secretaries of state for election security purposes in the 2018 election. The money was meant mostly to help states beat back would-be hackers in the 2018 election. And I want to say a word here. This has been bipartisan in this chamber. Hat tip here to Representatives Nash and O'Driscoll, not in the room, but they have been absolute stalwart allies in this. So I don't want to suggest that it's been anything but bipartisan in this chamber. In the other chamber, not so much. The Minnesota Senate blocked those funds for reasons that no one even today can articulate with a straight face. As a result, we were the last in America. Minnesota was dead last, 50th in the country, to get those funds. And worse, we didn't get them until after the 2018 election. So they were meant by Congress for states, for secretaries of state, and their partners in the local government to use in the 2018 election for election security. And we didn't get them until 2019. They were held up. They were blocked. More than a year after they were appropriated. So the law really doesn't make sense for that reason. And I just want to say one thing for the record. I believe in legislative oversight, even when we are the subject of it. That is an important function of the legislature, and it's important that all public entities be held accountable, us included and us especially, I would say. So this isn't about getting rid of oversight, but there already is some. There are many channels of oversight. And moreover, you've already got the leverage of the matching funds. So let's take it out of the context of today. 10 years from now, 15 years ago from now, 20 years from now, if you don't like the way that, if you, the legislature, don't like the way that a Secretary of State is proposing to spend this money that Congress intends the Secretary of State to have, you can withhold the matching funds. That's your stick. So you always have that under federal law. This just says you shouldn't also be able to hold up the 80% that Congress has said is intended for the states. It's getting in the way of a congressional appropriation. And just for the record, there's already oversight here in the way of federal reporting requirements. In fact, I just signed our latest report yesterday by sheer coincidence. We have to do quarterly updates to the federal government about how we're spending the money, track it, make sure it's within the congressional purposes and so forth. And you can always layer on to that. I would have no objection to that. You should know, and you should ask tough questions about how we're spending that money. And that leads to the second part of the bill. Because of the abuse of the current law, we are now a year behind other states on yet another round of federal funds. So Minnesota's portion of those funds is $2,302,244, $2.3 million and change. The money is literally sitting in an account right now at MMB, but we can't touch the money in that account for the purposes Congress intended unless we get the 20% match, which is $460,000. So that's our request, $460,000 in this biennium, unlike the other budget bills that will be before you, not in the coming 24-25 biennium, but right now, and the one that is to expire on June 30th, so that we can get the federal funds that we believe every other state has already received. The third part of the bill, as Representative Freiberg teed up, is a one-time, and I would say once a decade, request relating to redistricting litigation fees that our office owes as a result of the 2022 redistricting conducted in the courts. Now, as many of you know, we have very little to do with redistricting. We don't draw the maps. We're not involved in that. But strangely, somewhat strangely, every 10 years, this office is what they call the necessary defendant. So when you have the litigation, it's always such and such or so and so versus Office of the Secretary of State. And that's the hook. That's why that line item is coming out of our budget. So we're more or less passive when it comes to redistricting, but we're always the defendant. This is the case 10 years ago under Secretary Ritchie, 20 years ago under Secretary Kiffmeyer, 30 years ago against under Secretary Groh. Every 10 years, this is an expense. An attorney's fee award is made at the end of the litigation, and it always comes out of the Secretary of State's budget. So this year, that was $477,000. As Representative Freiberg correctly said, interest is accruing. The meter is always running on this payment. So it's at the rate of 5% annually right now. So the state would save at least $10,000 if the legislature paid these fees today under the current biennium instead of putting it in budget bills that take effect July 1st. So we're asking for $477,000, give or take. The meter's always running, so maybe a tad more in this biennium, not the next biennium. I hope that we can work together to pay this amount quickly to avoid further costs to the state of Minnesota. That's all I've got. Thanks for your time and attention, members.
Thank you, Secretary Simon. Are there any members of the public that wish to testify on this bill? Hearing none, I think, Mr. Chair, I think I'll turn to the amendment.
Sure.
We have an A1 amendment, Representative Altendorf. Would you like to move and describe the A1 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Secretary of State. Actually, I am moving to withdraw my amendment, and I just had a question for the Secretary of State. What are your plans for the $2.3 million?
Thank you, Representative Altendorf. Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Altendorf. Yeah, we just filed our latest iteration yesterday of our plan, and I'm happy to provide you the details afterwards, but I can summarize it in a few blocks. One big block is that we plan to make grants to local governments. That's a big part of the partnership here. You know, we can do a lot when it comes to election security, but we're only as strong as our weakest link. And we have 87 county partners, we have city partners, and we need to shore up that security arrangement with them. So we do that in a couple ways. One is just money that it sort of goes in the top of the funnel and it comes out the other end by formula to counties. The other is through personnel. We have a election security navigator program in our office, as many states do now. I think it's 20-some states, where we have a person, now two people, whose job it is to coordinate security, including physical security, among the counties. So this person, I think he's been before this committee before, Bill Ekblad, Minnesota native, career naval officer, with an intelligence background. He is our sort of liaison to the counties. He makes house calls. He goes around the state. So this, in part, helps to fund his salary and his deputy's salary. Those are the broad brushstrokes, but I'm happy to get you the physical, actual plan that the federal government has asked for. I'm happy to do that after the hearing.
Thank you. Thank you, Secretary Simon. Thank you.
Any follow-up from Representative Altner? With the amendment being withdrawn, I think we can move to member discussion. Representative
Peter. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill. My question is for the Secretary of State, Steve Simon. Something in your testimony that I caught that I'm curious about, because we're all here because we care about election security, and something you said just kind of made my ears wide open was you had said there's attempts of hacking, and you're using this money to help stop mm-hmm. hacking. Can you go a little more into detail? Like,
sure.
Like maybe what entities or groups or types of persons,
right.
And how are they going about that? Thank you.
Yeah, great question. Thank you, Representative, Madam Chair, Representative, thank you very much. So I mentioned, I think also, that in the past few years, the HAVA money has been used for that specific purpose, as opposed to other things like building databases and things like that. This HAVA money was focused, the last few times they've doled it out, has been focused on security. And really, you can divide election administration into two halves, pre-2016 and post-2016. Because in 2016, one really event, once-in-a-generation event changed a lot of people's thinking on how to spend this federal money. And that was in 2016. We know that Minnesota was one of 21 states that was targeted by a foreign adversary. I say targeted by because they were unsuccessful. The bad guys didn't get through. The systems worked. But it was a real wake-up call across the country to potential vulnerabilities. And when I talk about hacking or people trying to get in, what I'm referring to specifically is not things like elections equipment, although that's always a possibility, right, as is anything in our modern world. I'm talking about the attempt, in the unsuccessful attempt, I should add, in 2016 to get into the big databases that are the spine of the system. In Minnesota, we call it SVRS, the Statewide Voter Registration System, but all 50 states have some system. It goes by different names in different states. So a foreign adversary we know in 2016 tried unsuccessfully to get in there in Minnesota. They were more successful in two other states, Illinois and Arizona. Not much more, but more. And so since 2016, and this has been totally bipartisan, it was the Trump administration, it's the Biden administration, hats off to the folks in the intelligence community who have been really focused on this regardless of party. And so when I talk about hacking, I'm talking about attempts in particular that we know of that did happen to get into SVRS or similar databases in other states. That's when Congress, to its credit, under whether it was Speaker Paul Ryan or Speaker Nancy Pelosi, they've been really united here, really came to understand that cybersecurity is expensive. It's no different in the election realm than any other realm, and that, as some of us put it often, and as many of you know by personal experience, cybersecurity really is a race without a finish line. You know, you always have to stay one step ahead of the bad guys, always. There is no tape at the end of the race. There is no end zone dance. You always have to stay one step ahead, and they get smarter every year, and some of them are bankrolled by foreign governments. So the Department of Homeland Security, no matter who's been in charge, has really been focused on this. So when I talk about hacking, I'm talking in particular, at least what's going on in the back of my mind is the 2016 unsuccessful attempt to get into the databases. That's what I'm primarily talking about, although it's a broader effort than just protecting that one portion of the system.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that, Mr. Secretary. I guess one more question. Has Minnesota had these same attempts in the 2020 election, 2022 election, and as you were mentioning before, the 2018 election?
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. To our knowledge, no, nothing like 2016. 2016 was the case in which Minnesota and 20 other states faced an attempted attack. Again, unsuccessful in the case of Minnesota, but that That was the real wake-up call for everyone, I think, around the country. But so the short answer to your question is no, nothing like that.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the Secretary, and thank you, Chair Freiberg. You know, being here during that time and being part of that lovely IT contingent here, we are really lucky. We have a very united IT group, a very powerful but mighty IT caucus. Most of us sit on the Technical Advisory Council, which is a public-private partnership with state agencies and legislators that talk about how to tackle the challenges of IT today and how to do it in a people-centered way, how to make government work for real people. And we have often talked about in the public sector and in private and state agencies how this impacts us. And, you know, I appreciate that the Secretary said, you know, cyber criminals don't give up. They don't just say, you know what, I wasn't successful today. I think we should pack up our toys and go home. It's not how they work, right? So it's not that they're ever going to stop trying. They will continue to stop trying. And I just want to ground us that, you know, what happened a couple of years ago was really unconscionable. There is no circumstance under which the safety and security of our state and our infrastructure should be a political football. That's absolutely unacceptable. It just is. And I think that I can speak reasonably that Republicans, Representative Nash, Representative O'Driscoll, even our newly minted Senator Lucero would tell you that that is unacceptable. You know, we cannot risk our elections. We cannot risk our state infrastructure. There is just no reason for that. It is our duty to secure the safety and security of our state's infrastructure and the safety and security of our citizens. We have to do that. That's our job. And there is no circumstance where we should be allowed to use this for political means. And so I just want to say thank you for this and also make sure that we're clear that when we have these funds that come from the federal government for things like cybersecurity and safety, they generally come for a specific purpose or have specific specified parameters. This is not a free-for-all. This is not, you know, they have very good purposes, including some current money that looks at trying to strengthen state and local governments, because we are only as strong as our weakest link. And I know that our cities, our counties, and other places are clamoring for the ability to do this on that level as well. So I just want to say thank you for this. And I do think that the fact that Minnesota is an outlier here speaks volumes. And we really need to make sure that we are doing our duty here as state legislators, that we are getting those funds taken care of, and that we are making sure that we are securing those assets for the state of Minnesota and our citizens. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Lead Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. At the risk of eating up some of our committee members' free time, I'd like to delve a little bit into the area of redistricting. The third part of this bill. First question, we see here the 477 that's before us. Do you recall the amounts involved 10 years ago and 20 years ago when similar action was taken?
Mr. Secretary, or Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson. I don't. That's readily available. I'm looking over to Ms. Freeman. Do we know? We can find that out. And Representative Torkelson, I imagine where you're going, is this comparable? Or, you know, inflation adjusted, is it comparable? I think so. I don't recall seeing anything that made my eyes pop out in terms of this being abnormally high. But I don't want to speculate, I suppose. Look, we can get you that number.
Lead Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Secretary. Actually, I think it was substantially higher 10 years ago, if I remember correctly, but I was just trying to refresh my own memory, actually. Looks like we have help coming.
Real-time research.
Representative Torkelson, thank you. This is why you always want Ms. Freeman instead of me. She's the brains of the operation, among others. So here it is. I have it right here. In 2012, the amount was, or I guess 2013, it was $345,000. And in 2002, it was $368,000. So it went from $368,000 down a little bit to $345,000 and now up to $477,000. I'm speculating, Representative Torkelson, that one reason for it to be a little bit higher was typically there are one or two lawsuits. This time there were three, as you may recall. I know you were heavily involved in redistricting, and that might have had something to do with it. So you had three sets of lawyers, three different batches of plaintiffs, not the usual one or two. That probably accounts for the increase.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. And my assumption is those probably from 2002 and 2012 are not inflation adjusted. So are we also talking about that? Okay.
That's correct, ma'am.
Lee Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that clarification. That was going to kind of be my point, that we had more plaintiffs involved in this time around. Is there, and I assume there's really no limit on how many plaintiffs might get involved in this process. You know, it's, it only happens every 10 years. It's by the time we get to the next cycle, most of us probably won't be involved. There was a bit of an unbalance this time around in the number of plaintiffs and a lot more on one side than the other. And I'm thinking that maybe actually pushed up the costs here. Any comments on that, Mr. Secretary?
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Torkelson, I think you're probably right. That would be my guess, too. Three, I don't know that in the other cycles, the last two, there were that many lawsuits. And this time, there were a group that were basically Democratic plaintiffs, basically Republican plaintiffs, and then one that purported to be neither. But I think you're onto something that probably explains it.
Lee Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Secretary. Well, that's really all the farther I'm going to go with this. I just admonish those that might be here 10 years from now to get involved early and pay a lot of attention to what happens with redistricting. We have an expert over here in nonpartisan staff that is a national expert, frankly, and hopefully some of this expertise will be around when we need it in 10 years. Our system is a little unusual in that that we almost certainly seem to take it to the judges every time, and that's part of the reason we have these costs. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Lee Torkelson. Do I hear a nascent conversation about redistricting reform in there? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on the labeling of the former disagreements as being political, I think it's more because a certain senator was a former Secretary of State and had ideas of where that money should be spent, and also was someone that I believe oversaw a major upgrade or bringing in of a new software system that then was recently updated again, and that a lot of the senators took that experience and knowledge and input to heart and pushed for a slightly different vision with some of the funds, which, that's part of the legislative process. Another part of the way the legislative process was set up by the Constitution was legislative oversight. Sometimes it's a difficult thing. I've seen and observed that as being part of it, and the frustration that other government entities have expressed with our process. But you can't always, sometimes you can't find a friendly judge to ignore legislative intent. But the legislation and the legislature have abdicated so much authority to rulemaking in the bureaucracies, to other entities within government, that I have some reluctance to increasing the erosion of legislative oversight, because it's our responsibility to get into the messy work and be the voice of the people and how things are done, to express and define legislative intent to make sure things are done the way we intend. So I would, you know, oppose the bill in its current form and stand up for the authority, the power of the legislature.
Thank you, Representative Combe. Seeing nobody else on the list, I'm going to turn it back over to you, Chair Freiberg, if you want to respond, and for closing comments.
Sure. No, I appreciate the perspective and the questions. You know, I do think this is critical election security funding. I appreciate Representative Quam's position, but I don't feel that legislative oversight of these funds have been productive. I think it's been counterproductive the last few years. The requirement is unique in the nation, and I don't think it served us well. As Secretary Simon said, even if we get rid of that, there would still be accountability with the matching funds and the reporting to the Election Assistance Commission on a quarterly basis. So I think this is good policy. I think it's needed funding, and I would encourage members to support it. And I guess with that, I will renew my motion that House File 1723 be recommended to be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Freiberg renews his motion that House File 1723 be recommended to be re-referred to the State Government and Local Finance and Policy Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say nay. The motion prevails. House File 1723 is recommended to be re-referred to the State Government and Local Policy and Finance Committee. With that, Mr. Chair, okay. With that, seeing no further business, committee is adjourned. Right.